You're listening to episode 135 of the Furler Bros Tech Podcast, soap operas, and other TV shows.
Welcome to episode 135 of the Furlough Bros Tech Podcast. Today is April the 27th, 2014. I'm Matthew Dean Furlough, and this is my segueing brother, James Furlough.
That's right. For the first time ever, I got to ride a segue this week. Did a little...
That's pretty cool.
...tour of the town. It was pretty awesome.
Which town? Your town? Your town,
Oregon
USA?
Town. Yep, yep. Any town, USA. Yeah, cool devices. Have you ever ridden on one?
I have not, which actually I think is kind of surprising considering the fact that they, for a while, though, they were kind of omnipresent because the vaulted Steve Wozniak was a huge fan of them, so they're... And since he lived, like, within a mile of me, I saw them occasionally. But
yeah,
no, I never actually got to use one.
What's interesting is they're like $6,000, so they're not cheap.
Yeah,
and
not at all.
You could buy a golf cart for that amount of money and actually carry stuff with you, and it goes faster. But yeah, so they're cool. So in case you live under a rock and don't actually follow tech, a Segway is a machine with two wheels on it, and basically what it does is it uses gyroscopes and them moving to keep you upright. And so you step
moving.
Onto it. What?
And them moving, yes.
Yeah, and moving. And so you step onto them, and you got like a little handle you're holding onto. And if you lean forward, instead of you falling over, it rolls essentially to get back underneath you. And so you move forward. If you lean back, you slow down, stop, and eventually it'll go backwards. It can go up to 12 miles an hour going forward, 3 miles an hour backwards.
Oh, baby.
Fun fact, any machine that goes over 15 miles an hour needs to be registered with the DMV. And so they have a governor on there that only allows it to go up to 12 so that you can go on sidewalks and go into the street and essentially treat it like a bicycle.
Now, if you are a fancy-dancy hacker dude and you have the capabilities and could take the governor off, is it physically capable of going over much over 15, or is that sort of a... Is it a physical limit as well? Do you know?
I think they said it could go like 20, 24 miles an hour, so like twice as fast.
Holy cow.
Potentially.
That's
Which,
moving.
having, yeah,
that's
having ridden on it,
good.
I that would scare me, because you hit a bump and like there's nothing strapping you down. And,
right.
And so I feel like you would fall off. And it doesn't keep you up side to side. You're on your own there, but I mean, it's good.
Right.
You got two wheels. And,
No. You finished what your thought was.
What's also interesting about it is that the steering column is, you're still pretty quiet, and I don't know why. I don't know how to make you louder. But,
I'll yell. I'll speak louder.
Okay. I might try. We'll try this too. If I ever end up playing anything, it will be very loud. But anyways, to steer, you, like I said, you've kind of got your think of it like a bicycle handles that you're holding on to. But
yeah.
What's interesting about them is that the column goes down to where your feet are, and then there is a cylinder, and essentially that cylinder rotates. Okay, so when you want to turn left or right, and you got your handlebars. You don't turn it like a bicycle where you would pull one and pull the other. Instead, you push down. And you,
weird. So it's kind of like you lean.
Rotates. Yeah, you do. And you actually you feel like you're leaning, and therefore it feels like the Segway is working for you. It's weird. It's a weird sensation to be like, okay, I'm turning, so I just lean into it kind of like a bicycle. But you were literally pressing down on it, and the fulcrum's at your feet, and so the entire thing rotates.
Weird.
And they're all subtle movements too, right? I mean, we're not talking you lean an inch and you start to turn, you know.
Right. So, can I drop a couple of fun Segway facts on you? Because
sure.
they're fun, and we got 2 hours to fill, let's be honest. actually, this week is not a good week to fill time, but I'm going to do this anyways because they're fun. So, fact number one, the CEO of Segway was invented by, what's his name, Dean Cain? Yeah. That was not the fun fact. Dean Cain sold Segway after everyone, you know, because he pumped it up as like the future of transportation, and then nobody bought them because they're $6,000 personal scooters, and they're kind of ridiculous. They're really cool technology, but no, it's stupid as a consumer product. It's stupid as a commercial product, too. Nobody buys them. But there was a guy, he bought the Segway, CEO of the company, and then died when he fell off a ravine driving one. Which is pretty morbidly funny, but for like a super safe device, that was pretty rough. Number two fun fact, Dean Cain, he's not quite as cool as Elon Musk, but he's like same like class of just kind of super awesome engineering superhero. And he is responsible for like 90% of the really great innovations that have happened in automated prosthetic limbs. And he says that one of his team's goal is they're going to keep making prosthetic limbs better until the guys that have lost their limbs have the guys that still have their limbs be jealous of them. And they're like, and then we'll stop. We're not going to go any further. We're not going to get beyond human. But once get to on par. Yeah, I know. Right. Well, that's where he stops. And that's where the real money men take over. But yeah, so he's doing some really incredible work. He's a cool guy. And then the last thing is I was friends with a guy for about 4 years who his video on YouTube was the number one guy flipping over the front of a Segway video, because he was friends with Wozniak's kids, and so he took them out and were being stupid, and one of them hit a hard like bump or something, his head, you know, flew over the handlebars, and wow. it was the top ranked one. So yes, fun Segway facts.
Yeah, those are fun. It's also you totally stand out, and So we were going around, and every single place that we went, there were people who were like hooping and hollering us and shouting at us. It's like, oh yeah, Segway! And just like, it was weird. Just be like, all right, people.
Did you wear a bike helmet?
Yeah, I did. I ate what they make us.
Oh, dude.
The tour guide didn't have to, but I did.
Like, seriously?
Oh, I look like a total goob. It's pretty funny.
I know. Yeah, seriously.
You should look me up on a. If you go to Instagram, which I am at James Furlough on Instagram, I'll segue for you.
I'm gonna say you can
see a picture.
To our next topic. What?
Oh, I was just saying I segued for you.
Yes, thank you. So, speaking of, this week, you know, we're just going to go into the show opening at this point. This week, like every week, we're going to be talking about Segways and the continuing, talking about technology and the continuing corporate opera. Man, I'm fumbling over myself today. And by corporate opera, what do we mean? We mean the soap opera of corporations' dealings back and forth, the people working for them, their marketing campaigns, and of course, the technology they're developing. As James mentioned, we have a few show preliminaries. One of those is our social network call signs. But before we do that, James has a disclosure that he does want to throw our way so he doesn't get in trouble.
Yes, I work for HP, but I do not represent HP or any of HP's opinions.
Nice. And as he mentioned, you can find us all over the internet. My Instagram, because I'm difficult, is nextwiggin4, NextWiggin, the number 4. Oh, yeah, my Twitter is at Matthew D. Furlough.
And I am James Furlough on Twitter. I am jamesfurlough.com on the regular web. I am James Furlough on that other one, and most other ones.
The World Wide Web. As he mentioned, if you had been following him on the Netflix, not the Netflix, goodness gracious, this is going to be a long show for me.
Oh, man.
On the Instagram, you would have gotten the preview of the helmeted James on a Segway. Yep. That's why I knew to ask about it, because I knew you'd have to tell the honest answer. Ha ha ha. But yeah, so check that out. Also, at the end of this show, we're going to have all sorts of cool things on our website, furloughbros.com. There you'll see links to the YouTube videos, to the podcast shorts, to all of the everything we talk about this week. Anything cool, articles, whatever, it's there for you to check out, to view at your leisure. James is showing the picture of him.
There it is.
Oh, man.
It's totally blurry.
It's just...
blurry cam.
Your wife is one lucky lady.
That she is.
But... yeah, so... good time.
Distracted you with that.
Yeah, that was cool. Probably the worst segue I've ever had.
Oh, man.
Cool. Really try right. to get us, like, you know... yeah, whatever.
Let's talk anyway, about something more fundamentally tech-related, then.
Yes, I like this. So, obviously, we've been jawing on about graphene. What is graphene? For those of you who don't listen to every minute of this show, why not, first? Secondly, so that you can catch up, graphene is a pretty cool new material. It is a particular lattice of carbon. Carbon, you know, is cool in that just because of the geometry and the number of electrons that it can connect with stuff, it's got these cool geometries that it can make. And when it's in a very, you know, especially when it's pure carbon, it creates these different lattices. In a very open, broken lattice, you have, like, pure carbon piles, and it's very dark, and it looks like a hyper-burned charcoal. Like, it's just very – it's you touch it, and it kind of carbonizes. But that's in its least pure – or in its least organized form. There are other organized forms, like your carbon nanotubes, which are these little tubes that go on theoretically for a long time, but we've never been able to manufacture them in length. So they've got these really great properties, like they can conduct electricity and they're super strong, but they're also super small and just kind of cause cancer.
That's bad.
Lung cancer specifically. Yeah, it's not. They didn't stack up to what we were hoping they would. There's also things like diamonds, which are very cool because they those are really hard and, you know, classic diamond stuff. Once again, just a carbon lattice. There's buckyballs, which are these ultra tiny little balls, very, very difficult to break. But once again, you know, they're so small they cause cancer. But then there was this sort of like the new wonder material made of carbon. And one of the cool parts about carbon is it's a super abundant molecule on Earth and throughout the universe. So it's, if you can figure out how to manufacture really cool things with it, it's a cheap element. It's not like the heavier elements that are difficult to make things with. This is something we can make. We got tons of it. We can make tons of stuff. So we found this new wonder material called graphene. And it turns out we've all been using it forever in the form of graphite. Graphene is a single layer of carbon and in its particular lattice. And so it's very flexible, but it's such a strong lattice that it's, because of how it's crystal lattice, it's hard to break. It's got cool tensile strength and stuff, and it also has these tiny little holes. You can use it for like purifying water through osmosis, but because it's so thin and so strong, you can build these very low power osmosis water purification stuff. Very cool. And there's also, it's also, if you dope it properly, you can make semiconductive materials. You can replace parts that you would traditionally make with pure silicon, you can now make them with this really, you know, which silicon's very cheap and abundant too, which is why we use it for so much. But carbon graphene has all sorts of other cool properties. And basically, as I mentioned earlier, so graphite is a block of graphene. So it's sheet on sheet on sheet on sheet, which is why when you take graphite in your lead pencil, which I don't know why we call it lead, but, you know, well, I do know why we call it lead, but when you draw across, basically what's happening is you're taking the sheets of graphene, these tiny little sheets of graphene, and breaking them off. And those sheets are laying out on your piece of paper, and those pieces, those little sheets, are what gets left behind. That's how we write with a lead pencil that's actually made of graphite. And why does all this matter? Because obviously, I'm saying there's these cool technology possibilities, but the big problem that everybody has had is, how do you separate the layers? How do you actually get them into individual sheets? How do you get the sheets to be very big? Because if you could like get very big sheets, you could turn them into strips, and then you could make all sorts of you could make what are those called? Composite materials, where you use glue and you bind them all together, and you can make kind of like, you know how like carbon fiber stuff is really strong, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Well, this is like a billion times better because it's pure carbon. Carbon fiber is actually, it's carbonized fiber. So you take cotton fibers, you get it really hot, you bake off most of the hydrogen and oxygen that makes up the fibers, and then what's left are these strong, low weight carbon fibers. Well, graphene's like that, but on steroids. It's even better. And so, big deal this last week, pretty much the day after the podcast, I think it was Monday, a group from Ireland announced that, hey, we figured out how to get these sheets off and have them separated. Up to this point, there's been a couple of different strategies that people have used that they've had limited success with. The best one is taking Scotch tape, sticking down some Scotch tape and just peeling a sheet off, which works pretty well, but it's not perfect. The sheet can like fold back on itself, and just the nature of graphene, if you get two sheets lined up together, they stick really well together until you break them apart. So if the sheet folds back on itself, you got a problem. So you have to do things to make sure that they don't stick, and we've been having a hard time figuring out how to do that. And then we've also got just, how do you break off the large sheets? How do you do this in an easily manufacturable way? There's a bunch of big questions that people have been trying to answer, and this group, it looks like they've figured it out. There's been a lot of really great work done on how to manufacture really big pieces of graphite that are very, very well organized. So you end up with essentially a bunch of really great, perfect sheets of graphene. And what they are doing now, and this is so awesome because it's so low tech. They basically took a blender, put water and soap in it, and so it's just soapy water. Turn the blender on, and then stick the block of graphene, just hold it in the water, and the movement of the water is enough to grab the graphene sheets and just shoot them off like you're, flicking paper, nice. Money and stuff. And then the soap coats the sheets of the graphene, and they won't stick to themselves, and they won't stick to other sheets of graphene. And so basically you end up just with a bucket full of graphene sheets. You can just grab it and pull it out, and it won't stick to anything. It's just like, whoa, you did it. Like, you just did it. Like, and so this is like a huge deal because we're basically to the point now where we're figuring out how to successfully manufacturing large pieces of graphene, large sheets of graphene. We now know how to very cheaply manufacture large chunks of them. So the real question now is, like, it's now a matter of, now we've got the material in large quantities. It's probably a year or two before you can really get it, because you're going to have to scale up big manufacturing plants to be able to really produce it. You're going to have buyers who have something to do with it, which there's all sorts of possibilities, but those are other big factories that need to buy it in quantity. But the fact of the matter is, now it's like, now you're at the point of all the fundamental technologies are in place. Now it's a matter of just figuring out how to scale these factories even bigger and bigger. How do we ship it? Who's going to buy it? Who's going to build our osmosis plants? Who's going to build our new Wonder bulletproof vest? Who's going to build our new whatever? And so it's exciting. It's really cool because they're up until this point, really, it's been kind of the same ballpark as graphene or carbon nanotubes, where they're great in theory, they're amazing in labs, and they're just absolutely useless commercially and in the real world, because you could never get them in a size and volume that was really useful. Whereas this is not that, evidently. We're actually making them at manufacturable levels, and hopefully next couple of years we'll have some cool new graphene composites that, you know, will be hitting the shelf. You'll get your fastest boats and your fastest cars and stuff will be, you know, won't be carbon fiber shells, they'll be graphene shells.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, so it's exciting. The future, it's awesome.
It's almost now. Almost.
Yeah. What's really exciting, and actually I think this is the most underreported idea about this, is carbon is cheaper than steel, than iron. You have to mine for iron. Carbon's basically everywhere. And it's so easy for us to get carbon. And there's a chance that, depending on how expensive glues are and stuff, that this is the sort of thing that eventually we start making composite I-beams for buildings. And, you know, if it's easy enough to manufacture this stuff, it's the sort of thing that can replace steel. Which is a huge deal. It could be as big a deal as plastic itself was, you know, and going forward, which is exciting.
That is cool.
But,
that is exciting. I want to switch gears a little bit here.
Okay.
I think I can do this, but we'll find. You'll tell me if I did it successfully or not, but kind of to the law side of technology, kind of, for a bit. First, I want to talk about Pandora, and then we'll get into net neutrality. And I think in some ways they're related, but in a sense that they're non-market competition, but they're both interesting.
Cool.
And I think I can do
Lay
this,
it on, man.
But we're going to try. So Pandora released their quarterly earnings last week, and they lost money again. And
yay.
Yeah, I know. But they also are expected to either break even or have a 3-cent profit on their revenue of, you know, per share, I guess. So they're hoping to yeah, which I don't know. I think that equates to like 3% profit, the way that they're talking about it. So Pandora, they're still struggling financially, but it sounds like they might be getting out of it. Another interesting fun fact about Pandora is that their listener hour grew 12% from the last period.
Their listener hour, what does that mean? What is that value?
So, like,
metric.
Yeah, it's how many people are listening per hour, perhaps? Or how many hours of the day?
Okay, well, if you don't know the answer, that's fine too, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
But it's still growing, albeit slower than it has in previous periods. So part of it is Pandora is starting to mature as a company, which is kind of scary, being that they're still losing money and they're starting to mature. You know, usually you're like, we don't want that to happen. But, so they're going through that. And what was interesting is they asked them, you know, well, you know, things are slowing down. Do you think that's because of competition from, say, Apple and Google and, you know, Spotify and Beats and, you know, things like that? To which they were like, no, not really. You know.
Oh, so they lied.
Well, you know, they're probably like, it's weird, you know. They probably don't notice the numbers directly, though I'm sure it's there. But what's more interesting in all of that, and that was just more of the segue into a bigger discussion that I was reading on Quartz, that was titled "Why the Music Industry is Trying and Failing to Crush Pandora." And what they're saying is, you know, it's been 15 years since the launch of Napster, which changed everything, as we know. And, you know, internet-based music platforms such as Pandora are, you know, they're they're real. They're legitimate, maybe is the right word. And but then there's also the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, otherwise known as ASCAP, that really hate Pandora and you know, what everyone else, you know, all internet stuff. So so Pandora right now, they just went through a case in through the courts, and in that courts they decided that Pandora had to pay what they have been paying, which is 1.85% of their gross revenue or something, to ASCAP, whereas they wanted to raise it to 3%, and Pandora was like, we'd like it to be at 1.7, which is what normal radio stations pay. And and so there's this whole, you know, the whole weird thing about the music industry, right? And we see this with movies too, where there's depending on the medium, changes the rates that you pay. And so, but what they were saying that is that, like, the way that the music industry was messing with Pandora, they're like, it was really, really complicated. Because they said essentially what happened was ASCAP got started, I think I'm going to get this right, because when you had all these discrete radio stations around the world, it was really hard for companies like BMI, which I don't remember what they stand for, and they don't say. So, you know, for individual publishing companies to police and collect money from all the radio stations across the world. So there was a single organization, which I think is actually PROS, P-R-O, and then plural because there's a lot of them, whose job it was to go out and collect that money.
Yeah.
But in the web, it's a little bit different than that. It's significantly more complicated because Pandora can't – they could – how do I want to say it? Like, because they're just one entity all across the web, they started out just working with this one, you know, organization that represents everybody. But then individual companies weren't happy with what was going on. And so they were like, well, we're going to try working with Pandora individually because it's just one. We're not talking about thousands of stations anymore. And we're going to try to negotiate our own deals.
That's annoying for Pandora.
Yeah, and kind of what took them all by surprise really was just how fast Pandora rose. And that's part of what they're like – they're trying to get a bigger piece of Pandora because Pandora is the biggest radio station in the world right now. You know, if you think of them in terms of a radio station, not iTunes, that's a different model. But in terms of streaming music, that kind of stuff, you know, even against all other radio stations, they're the biggest. And I think you and I can agree that that's largely due to the Music Genome Project, where they were saying that they classify tracks using 450 distinct different musical traits, and you know, and then they use that along with user feedback, and you know, they create compelling stations, which is cool. Okay, so let's see if I can do this right. Yeah, I don't know. So essentially, what happened here was, they wanted to charge Pandora just a ridiculous sum of money, and part of it was, you know, they're still being butthurt over Napster and all of that stuff, and you know, and they hate digital, and so they were like, well, let's charge them a ton because that's bad for us, right? If people can just play it, they're not going to buy it, which, you know, we've talked about that I think last week even, and so what happened was there was a company, I can't remember which one it was. I think it was BMI. That's a music publishing company, right?
Yeah.
That sounds familiar. they were ones where they, like I said, they decided to go rogue and like we're gonna do this ourselves and try to negotiate individually with them, and so they did, and essentially were like, say that again.
It's Broadcast Music Incorporated is the name of the is BMI. So yes, okay. They do. That's what they do. Broadcast music.
Yeah. And so what was interesting about them is that so they tried to negotiate with Pandora individually and like try to figure stuff out, and they were just playing hardball, right? Because they're like, no, we'll pull your music. And then what? Your catalog's right. Gonna stink because you don't have our awesome music stuff. Well, there were other companies that started to pay attention with that to what was going on there, and I don't remember the other one, but there was another company where they were like, "Well, we're gonna do the same thing," because it was set up where it was like you could either be represented by this company or go on your own, and so they went rogue on their own, and said, all right, well, we're going to try to negotiate with them. And then it came out in the court documents that they started sharing information with each other. Like that original company was like, hey, P.S., here's what we've learned about Pandora. Here's what we know about the raids. Here's what you can start, messing with them on and for their negotiation tactics. And so the judge...
I believe that's considered a collusion, correct?
Yeah, The judge did not... it was Sony was the other one. and there was there was this thing where Sony was totally messing with them. So Pandora was so Sony was one where they were like, no, we're going to negotiate individually, and so Pandora's like, well, okay, what's your music so that we can know what it is that we're talking about. And Sony just totally like kept messing with them and was like, we'll get that to you. We'll get that to you. Don't worry. We'll get it to you. So it was Sony who was doing that. And then it was Universal who then jumped on board next and started messing around with them. And so when it ended up, and there's a rule that says, essentially, and I don't know why this rule came about, but it is, that says if the music broadcaster and the music publisher cannot come to an agreement, it has to go to court, and the court will decide what the rate is. And so that's essentially what happened, is that it went to court, and that's when all this stuff came out, where they were like, they were both trying to push the royalty costs up from, that 1.85% to like 8%, just crazy numbers, and that they were totally colluding with each other and just being total jerks and not giving Pandora information so that they could actually, decide what it was that they were going to, be negotiating on. And right. It's an interesting system, and so I do not feel like I'm doing this justice at all. But the bottom line is that they held the court case, and Pandora is going to be required to pay 1.85%, which is still higher than radio broadcasters, but it's not like the crazy 8 or 25% or crazy numbers that the individual publishers were throwing around. So as a result, yes, Pandora did lose money last quarter, but they are forecasted and predicting that they will break even / actually make money next quarter.
Nice.
They're going to be around, the music industry's consternation.
Yeah. The thing that just astounds me continually about this is that it just seems like they still haven't learned anything. Because Napster obviously was... that couldn't go on. That was too sweet of a deal, and it was for Napster, and for us, I do believe that as a creator of content, you should be able to make money off of that. Blah, 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 blah. And I think that the philosophical debates about what is information, what is, medium versus media, I think that's all fun and dandy. But at this point, copyright. And if you want this music, people got to get paid for the work that they're doing. And so this is the
system we got. Really interesting part is that artists have started coming out and be like, Pandora's dumb. You know, like Bette Midler was like, she had 3 months of streaming on Pandora. They played over 4 million songs, and Pandora paid $114 to her. And and so she's like, what the heck? You know, and I guess Aerosmith had another similar thing. And so they're like, you know, Pandora's dumb and you can't make a living off of Pandora. To which Pandora pointed out that it actually pays out a lot more in royalties to record companies and publishers, because, and the artists and songwriters never actually see it. And
yeah,
you know, and so what they're coming out with soon, it sounds like, is an analytics dashboard similar to Google Analytics or Chartbeat, where they're actually going to lay out, here's how many of your songs were played over this amount of time, and here's what we paid out to it. So it will become very obvious how much they're paying and where that money is going.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting when they start just like, dude, Bette Midler, it's not us. Sorry.
Yeah, and the thing with the music industry is it's so weird because it's all, you know, because it's like there's multiple levels of ownership to a song, right? I mean, it's how does, you know, how is it that Paul McCartney is able to go on stage and play Beatles songs while at the same time technically the children of Michael Jackson, I think at this point, own the songs whenever they play on the radio. You know, it's like where, you know, when you get into those rules, and for those of you who don't know, the masters, the actual cut, the original recording, is owned separately from the original composition. So composition books, if you buy a book that has all the tab charts and the words and lyrics, that money goes to the composer, which was either Paul or John, and I think now Paul gets control of the stuff that John did, I think, at this point, which is why he's able to play it. But if you're actually playing the song on the radio, that money is going to the estate of the late great Michael Jackson, and so, you know, and a lot of times these, you know, there's companies that, you know, the record companies will own the masters. Like, that was a huge deal. That was what was like the big giant huge deal with what's his name, the blind guy who sings really good music, not Jamie Foxx, but Jamie Foxx played him. Ray, what's his name?
Charles.
Ray Charles. Thank you.
Stevie Wonder.
He demanded to own the gold masters, not just the composition rights to those songs, and so a lot of times these artists get completely cut out of the loop because it's like you'll get some. I was about to use Taylor Swift as an example, but she's an awful example as she actually writes her own music. But a lot of these artists that like don't write their own music, they'll get these like really weird contracts where they won't own the music, they won't own the masters, they won't own the composition rights because they didn't write the music. they're just like this middle person singing it, performing, and they're making all their money, you know, on tour and on stage and with their movie deals and their, you know, every time they sell a t-shirt. And so there's so many like different like levels and complications to all these things. Who owns what and how much do you get paid to this and everything? And Pandora is just getting, you know, beat left, right, and sideways by these different forces, all of them trying to get their cut. And there's so many people taking so much money at so many different levels, you know, and arguably the record companies are worth something because, you know, every town in America has some really great singer that if you made them lose 20 pounds, put some, you know, makeup on them and taught them a really catchy tune, they could sell a billion records if the entire mechanism that is the record industry to get behind them and turn them into a star. I mean, it's not there are some truly unique gifted performers, but a lot of this music is just kind of, you know, tripe that's it's enjoyable, fun, I like it, but it's, you know, the actual performer is kind of not terribly important. It's sort of who did the record company get behind, who did they advertise for, who did they put their money into promoting. you know, which is what they, and they've always said that they're an important, you know, element to that, and they should get paid for that. And it's just one of those things where it's like, the problem is that there's so many people on so many levels taking so many different cuts that everybody feels like they're getting the short end of the stick. And then they look at Pandora and you're getting all the money. Ugh. And you're like, but they're like, we're not making any money. What the heck? What are you talking about? You know, and the problem is that iTunes sales are falling. Apple has become isn't viewed as the big monster anymore. And as Pandora listenership is raising, and they are the biggest, you know, baddest guy, and they look like the easiest one that if we take these guys on, then we can get all our money finally.
Well, what's also interesting is that iHeartRadio is owned by Clear Channel. RDO is owned by Cumulus Media, and Spotify is owned by a handful of record labels.
I was going to say, and if you're not aware of Cumulus and Clear Channel, which why would you be? They're like the two radio station companies in America. They basically compete against each other in every market, and with incredibly few exceptions. Almost every station on the dial is one of those two big companies. They're gigantic companies. And so the fact that they also own, you know, the two biggest competitors to Pandora,
helps.
You know, and it helps a lot.
And so Pandora's the outsider, too, right? They don't have any friends like that. And that's another reason why they get picked on. I was reading, just trying to skim through this again to make sure I didn't miss anything. And Pandora does pay out 49% of its revenue. But most of it goes to recording companies and recording artists, not to publishers and songwriters. Which, in the radio world, 1.7% of the revenues go to record go to publishers, and record companies get nothing.
Huh.
Yeah. So, like, it's actually a very different thing. So it'll be interesting when they come out with that dashboard that shows, hey, here's how much things get played, here's how much we pay. To see where the money actually is flowing, because I think we're going to find that Pandora is not evil.
I doubt it, and I think the biggest problem that Pandora has is that I bet they're the cheapest thing out there, but I can't believe that. I mean, it's you know, people make money off, people make livings off of the radio and the radio alone if you can get enough plays. So you know, and people listen to more music because of Pandora. I can't believe that they're except Cumulus and Clear Channel are constantly, you know, cutting costs and fighting the battle of keeping you know, stations open and stuff, which, you know, because those giant antennas are not cheap. They're, you know, they consume a tremendous amount of power keeping the doors open, that sort of thing. It's, you know, it's on par with a server farm, you know, that Spotify or that Pandora is pumping. But you know, I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting.
Yeah, a final thought here that they had in the article was this guy just talking about how hard it is to do what they're doing. He says the fact that 15 to 20 years into the existence of digital music services, there has not been a single streaming service that has turned a profit on a cumulative or even an annual basis. The vast majority have gone out of business, okay? So he's like, you know, Pandora's in that group. He goes, could it be that every single company was mismanaged or couldn't find a business model? Because the only explanation that's rational is that the rates are too high. And so it's this weird balance, right, of like you got to find the right rate, but you also, like you were talking about, want to pay artists what they're due. It's not easy. But it sounds like Pandora's winning right now.
I think the one thing that everybody always forgets to mention, but it just does not get said enough, is that mid to late 80s, the rap, R&B, hip-hop boom began. And it was an entire new genre of music. They were signing artists like crazy. Some of the biggest moguls in the music industry today are rap, R&B, hip hop guys, because they got onto this rocket ship. And then right as Napster was coming around, and the advent of digital music, the rap, hip hop, R&B scene cooled, and the meteoric growth stopped. And I think that there's like as clear and easy as it is to understand the numbers, and I've seen the charts, I've read reports on it, as indisputable as it is that drove a lot of the slowing of growth that happened in the music industry, they still blame it on digital music. And like you said, they still haven't gotten over the Napster thing, you know, because they think that was the problem, not the fact that, you know, there's not been a new genre of music really and truly outside of like your dance music type, you know, techno stuff since R&B and hip hop and rap like that. There's generally, you know, there are cycles to these things. There's new genres that come in and they become, you know, they become popular and push a lot of the growth. And there's just they've freaked out so much about piracy, which once again, any one of these big companies, whether they're music companies or, you know, movie video companies, they tell you that privacy drives sales. And usually the biggest pirates are also the biggest spenders on legal content, because they value, you know, there's a you know, people who tend to watch a lot of stuff tend to pirate, and they also tend to watch a lot of stuff. And, you know, I'll use myself as an example. There might have been a time in my life that I was a scofflaw and I wanted to watch a lot of stuff. I could want to listen to a lot of stuff, couldn't afford it. Now I pay for just about everything because it's more convenient because I have money. And that's really common. And these guys just they refuse to accept that that's a reality and that there's any balance in there. You know, there are some artists that are embracing it and making crazy good money off of it. You know, they granted they've already got major prominence, they've already been promoted to the top of the game, so, you know, your bands like Nine Inch Nails and stuff like that, but they're you know, but it, so it's obviously possible to use this to their advantage and make better money than they ever could have. But interesting.
It is interesting. Okay. The next topic is net neutrality.
Which, not unrelated.
No, I mean, not really. I mean, they're similar in the sense that there's a lot of legal stuff going on. And there was this really good article by GigaOhm by Matthew Ingram, who just kind of did a really good job of talking about it. Because if you this week, I guess, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, says they're making some changes that are aimed to protect the free and open internet. And as we get further into this, you'll realize that no, it's not even close to that.
2 + 2 = 5, too.
Yeah, So, so what happened was back in January, there was a court case that came down about somebody. But essentially, the court case, the commission said that the FCC did not have the authority to crack down on certain types of behavior because it didn't define cable networks as common carriers. So, in other words, it was very interesting. Some other ones were not quite as nice about their description. But essentially, the courts were like, you did not write this well, and so therefore you have no authority.
Hmm.
You're just like, oh, what? And so the commission was like, all right, we'll fix that. And so, yeah. So that's why they're coming out with new rules, essentially. And you know, so they're coming out with new rules. And so the question was, you know, all right, well, what are these new rules that they're coming out with, right?
Right.
Essentially, the Wall Street Journal kind of interpreted them and said that the FCC is considering rules that would permit networks and carriers to create fast lanes, okay, in which certain content providers who pay for the privilege are given preferential treatment. Okay? Some people would argue that that sounds like the exact opposite of net neutrality, which I think I have it later in here. But essentially, net neutrality is this idea that everyone has access to content the same. essentially.
Right.
There is no special, Nest to anything. Customers don't have to pay an extra price for extra speeds to Netflix or even just access to Netflix. The bit's a bit is a bit is a bit is kind of the idea. And all of these cable operators are essentially common carriers. And that's it. But the FCC is like, well, we're going to create these fast lanes, which if you remember a few weeks ago, we were talking about the Netflix and Comcast deal. And they're like, something like that, where if Netflix wanted to pay Comcast extra money, they could get the fast lane and therefore the stream would be good. So people are not fans of this. So they're saying, like, this one guy, Tim Wu from Columbia Law School, says this is what one might call a net discrimination rule. And if enacted, it will profoundly change the internet as a platform for free speech and small-scale innovation. It threatens to make the internet, just like everything else in American society, unequal in a way that deeply threatens our long-term prosperity. Another guy calls it similar to axe murder, neutrality. So he's saying it actually lets things get worse. And Marco Armet, the creator of Instapaper, he was also a co-founder of Tumblr, and made the magazine as an iPhone app and ended up selling it. He's good at what he does. He says that... he says, this is not building anything new. It's discriminating and restricting what we already have. This is not making anything faster. It's allowing ISPs to selectively slow down traffic that they don't strategically or financially benefit from, and only permit traffic from their partners to run at the speeds that everything runs at today. And so he's like, we're not making things better. We're just giving special treatment. So it's kind of weird. So again, the idea of net neutrality was focused on the end consumer. The end consumer should not have unfettered access and should get access to everything. Access to everything, same speed. But there's no commentary on the back end of it. And this is kind of what it's talking about, where, well, on the back end, piping stuff in to Comcast Hub, is the way to do it. There was a replay of a podcast on Planet Money where they were talking about the internet and how it works, and they were like, given everything that's going on, it's a good time to replay this show. And so they were explaining how there's these big warehouses and there's literally just cables coming in from all over the world, and the cables come in and then there's a big switching house, right? And so all the information goes in to the cables and then out the Comcast cable to the person's house, and all those big switcher boxes are what happens. And they were saying you get companies
the
like
routers.
Yeah, essentially. Huge, complicated routers. And they were saying that, for a company like Netflix, the problem was that they were just getting caught in the traffic of it all. And so essentially what Netflix said is, hey, you got all these routers and storage house here, but you also have storage. How about storing our content for us in your little switcher house? And so when someone requests something, instead of saying, hey, Netflix, can you get it for us, you have the content.
Get it for
us. Just send it. And so it switches all the networking stuff and it just goes straight to the end customer. So that was the deal that Netflix actually made with Comcast. And I think it's interesting that they're fighting back and forth now. We'll see how that works out for you. But the idea would be, so it's not quite that. It's just, if you have a company, say, I don't know, you might have like Amazon, right? We want our site to load really, really, really fast. Yeah, give us the fast lane option. And so I think a lot of them, I'll be honest, we'll keep going and then I'll give my commentary, I guess. So the FCC replied back, right? And they were like, whoa, whoa, whoa. That's not exactly what we're doing here. what they were saying is that under the new rules, the commission would continue to ensure that ISPs and networks do not act in a commercially unreasonable manner to harm the internet, including favoring the traffic from an unaffiliated entity. to which the people were like, whoa, 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 what does commercially unreasonable mean? And who in the world right. are they talking about when they say affiliated entities? And so there's like, there's a lot of stuff in here that they're leaving